First of all, I would like to honor the mothers because they're the people who support our sons and daughters when they make these huge decisions in their lives. We're the ones who know them very well and know their hearts and know their minds and support them through these hard times. And I would like to have special recognition for Maritza Castillo and Camilo Mejia's daughter as well, Samantha. She's walking around. Samantha, would you stand? Would both of you stand, please, Maritza? Thank you, Maritza, for raising such a fine son. Well, from Vietnam to the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, to now, there's been a long and continual line of support for resistance and conscientious objection. It is handed down and supported from person to person, from heart to heart. And I've witnessed that, and I've been part of it, and I'm very grateful to have been. I have the great privilege of introducing a young woman that I have very high regard for. We met probably in 1991, I'm thinking, when Amy was a student body president of Stanford University. And also, kind of secretly, kind of quietly, she was also an Army reservist. That was the other thing she did. And she had a change of heart and became a conscientious objector. And I had the privilege of meeting her and, you know, driving with her to radio stations where she spoke eloquently. And Amy has continued with this work. She has helped in the process many young conscientious objectors and others, heart to heart, deeply. Her work has gone right into action to the next person. And she has time for this, even though she's a busy professional and a mother. And now, obviously, she's going to be an Oakland City Council member. She's got to win. If you know anyone in Oakland, vote for this woman. I'm telling you, it will get done. I can vouch for her. And it's such an honor to stand on this stage because she's given back and continues to give back. She worked with Stephen Funk and continues to support him as a friend through his process and has taken it as a lifestyle. I have to say of the resistors and the conscientious objectors that I knew and worked with, had the privilege of working with in Gulf War I, they stand on strong foundations, all of them, and they're doing well in their lives. I mean, you could be a mayor and a CO, right? We have Scott Kennedy to prove that and many other things. So, you know, yes! So it's with my great honor and warm feelings that I get to introduce this remarkable woman to you today, Amy Allison.
Hello, activists of Santa Cruz. This is amazing. I wanted to just take a moment to thank Veterans for Peace and Resource Center for Nonviolence. You know, you are very lucky to live in this city with remarkably deep anti-war roots and a community that embraces and supports the war resistor. Here, soldiers that develop and reassert their conscience and their humanity have a home. And you should be extremely proud that you're known across the country for that. Thank you so much for this. You are fabulous. I came to Santa Cruz 15 years ago as a person kind of like Robert in the back. And Robert, I want to honor you. It's the generation of soldiers who are coming to the place during this horrific and terrible war. It's the soldier that will stop the war. And it is the anti-war community that will make the soldier have the strength and the support to do the right thing. And so I was like you, Robert, 15 years ago, right? Like right here. And it's exciting that you're going through that process, and I support you 100%. It's the veterans, it's the longtime activists that make it possible for us to celebrate the incredible dignity and the courage of folks like Camilo. And it has been my honor to be here today to moderate. My own story, as April told you, began as a kid, one of six kids, looking for a way to go to college. And the recruiter was very supportive. You know, Amy, you have so much potential. You know, girls can do anything they want to do in their life. I know you want to be a doctor, and I know you want to be accomplished, so I have a solution for you. You can join the Army Reserves. It's just 6 years. Come on. And I was so desperate to get an education, and I knew my parents couldn't afford to help me at all. And so I went to downtown Oakland, and I signed up. And I put on that battle dress fatigue, and I went to boot camp. And I learned through an intensive 10 weeks of training to shoot M16s and M60s, to throw grenades with accuracy, to fight hand-to-hand combat, which, by the way, as a young woman, I'd never done. I mean, it's not something that a lot of young women practice, you know. But most of all, I learned to follow orders without question. You're not paid to think. You are paid to follow orders. In my medic training, I was a 91 Alpha, which is a combat medic. We learned how to put IVs in, and we learned how to stop blood flow and to do CPR and other things like that. But we also learned something called triage. And my mom's a nurse, so I know that triage in, you know, if something happened here, the earthquake in Santa Cruz, when that happened, a lot of people were injured. I know that triage normally means if you have a lot of people and they're injured or they need help, you take the person who's most injured and you help them first. But we were taught as combat medics to follow orders and support the military mission. If there's 10 people injured on the battlefield, you help the person who's most likely to return to support the military mission. We were told that the best thing that we can do as medics is to give severely injured soldiers on the field shots of morphine and allow them to die comfortably. And so the thing in me that I learned going to church, that I learned is that, you know, my humanity started welling up, but it took me 4 long years of going to military practice and exercises before my own unit, the 347th General Hospital in Sunnyvale, began to be activated. Now, a famous World War II CO said that being a conscientious objector between wars is like being a vegetarian between meals. And I often say that to people who've never joined and are not soldiers and couldn't understand how you could sign that contract and then go, but I can't do this. I can't be part of war. And for someone to reject the intense training, the training that they take and they instill upon kids who are developing the sense of themselves, 17, 18, 19 years old, and they teach you through song and by repetition and by forcing this chain of command, they teach you to subvert the things that you, that you know, but at some point, this humanity, this sense that I could not disobey my conscience became too strong for me to fight. And I decided, I learned through talking to my father and some of his friends that there was such a thing as getting an honorable discharge from the service as a conscientious objector. I also learned that fewer than 10% of the young men and women who attempt this are ever successful. You see, in my unit, I could apply for an administrative discharge as a conscientious objector as long as I followed orders. As soon as I refused orders, like, for example, if I'd received orders to go to the Persian Gulf, I'm no longer eligible to continue an administrative discharge if I refuse. So many of the soldiers who were asserting themselves as conscientious objectors don't ever get the official designation from the military, the honorable discharge as a conscientious objector. But those of us in the peace and justice community know that the soldier who refuses to fight is the greatest heroes that we have. And that, absolutely, those are our heroes. And no matter what the military calls the people who refuse orders to follow their conscience, no matter what they do, no matter how they're punished, that we as a community can embrace them, not just as speakers at a podium, but support their families, tell them long term, send them letters, let them know that they can be okay. And my work with Stephen Funk a couple of years ago shows me that with a community gathered to support resistors, it's possible to make that bridge, to take that bridge into wholeness. And in fact, Stephen and I talked last week. He's applying to Stanford. He's happy. He's moved in with his partner. He's living in San Francisco. He's a normal 20-year-old kid. And that is what we want. We want to take young people who are trained to follow orders without question, and we want to lead them to the path of wholeness. And something about being a conscientious objector changes those soldiers and makes them say, I believe in protecting and defending families and the community and people. There's something beautiful about that that sustains. That's why I'm running for city council in my city in Oakland, because I want recruiters off the campuses in my high schools. I want Oakland to be a sanctuary city for every soldier who refuses to fight in this unjust war. And so we can take our common love of peace and justice and apply it right here in our hometown. And there's no greater example of that than our guest, our next speaker, Mike Rotkin, our mayor, who has proven that you can take civic responsibility and your commitment to public policy and support peace and justice issues at a sustained, consistent way. And it's a wonderful model for someone like me who's trying to do it in my own hometown. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks so much. You know, the speech I came prepared to give, thankfully, I won't have to give. I was going to talk about why there were so few of us and times are difficult and the weather's bad, and I had all worked out, but thank you for coming tonight and making that speech completely irrelevant. I see a lot of the usual suspects here, but I also see a lot of new faces, people that I haven't seen at these kinds of meetings before, and I think that's very important. We have to grow, I think, as an anti-war movement and a community of conscience. I just want to say I was very privileged in many ways in the 1960s. I had the opportunity of having initially a student deferment and then an occupational deferment as a Vista volunteer that kept me out of the draft in the war in Vietnam, gave me time to think about the issues in that war. And so I was already the ripe age of 23 with a lot of time in a political movement when I finally, because I had burned my draft card and turned in my student deferment, was finally called to my draft physical, and they decided they didn't want me and declared me a security risk to the United States, and that's how I got out of the draft in the 60s. That's a luxury that a lot of young men and women, men in those years and now men and women, don't necessarily have, as the moderator here explained. The reality is there's huge pressure on young people living in a world where there are not jobs for people, where the access to education is severely limited, that make it very, very difficult for them to turned down the sort of inducement of serving in the military, the attractions of that. I want to be very careful not to misstate my views or what I think are probably the views of the majority, if not everyone in this room. The causes of war are not the individual soldiers or veterans of wars that have fought in them. People are dragged into this often at a very young age when they really have very little opportunity to think about what it means, what the implications are. It takes a huge amount of courage to resist the pressure that exists once you're caught up in that machine, and I think that's the right word for it, to think about, is this the right thing? What are the consequences of this? That's not something that's easy to do. As I said, I was privileged to be able to think about that. I didn't have to make up anti-war activism. I was surrounded by anti-war activists on a campus in the 1960s. But to be surrounded by people in the middle of fighting a war where you've been trained to follow orders, to do what you're told, to not think for yourself, to find your humanity in that kind of a context, that is very, very difficult to do. Much more difficult than to become an anti-war activist when you're not in the military. And I think that's why our honored guest this evening deserves the proclamation that I wrote for him, recognizing, and I'm not going to read it to you because it's in your program, so I'll save you the detailed whereases, except to read the last line, which I think is important, that based on Camilo Mejia's decisions, based on conscience, based on the illegality of the war, resisted that, and having attempted to get a conscientious objector status and being denied, decided that he simply was not going to allow himself to be used as a tool of an illegal and immoral war. And therefore, for that reason and the many others that I state in this proclamation, now therefore I, Mike Rotkin, mayor of the city of Santa Cruz, do hereby proclaim May 4th, 2005, as Camilo Mejia Day in the city of Santa Cruz. And I urge, in honor of his heroic example and courageous stand, and I encourage all local residents to join me in commending him for his actions. I now have the rare privilege of introducing you to this young man, this American hero. Please welcome him even more warmly. Thank you.
I want to thank everybody for being here. I'm not going to start naming new organizations because I know it took a lot of effort and a lot of people to put this wonderful day together. So I don't want to leave anybody out. But I want to say thank you to the city of Santa Cruz. I want to say thank you to the people of Santa Cruz, to everyone here present, to my family, of course, my daughter, my mother, my brother, and all the friends who have come here. And, of course, being a religious person, I want to thank God for today. Before I get to talking about this proclamation, I want to tell you a little bit about my story. And basically, it begins not very different from Amy's story, you know, being a young man, lacking a sense of belonging and feeling like I needed to go outside of home and outside of my community to find options, to find a college education and to find friends and to find adventure and stability. At age 19, I joined the military. I joined the U.S. Army. I went to Fort Hood, Texas, and spent 3 years as an infantryman. And I did find some of that sense of belonging. I did make a lot of friends and develop some real deep sense of brotherhood and camaraderie. I got out, had my wonderful little girl in the year 2000, went to college, joined the Florida National Guard, and just months before getting out of the military, just a semester before graduating, my unit was extended, and my end of contract date was extended by 27 years. So instead of leaving the military in the year 2003, now my ETS date, which is the end of contract date, was the year 2031. Picture myself being pushed in a wheelchair out of the military. So at this point, I have a very political opposition to the war. I'm not really all that deeply involved in it because I'm living a very comfortable life as a college student. I have my life going. I was applying for a PhD program in psychology, and I didn't really care that much about a war that was being fought halfway across the world. And the suffering of the people of Iraq and the suffering of the people all over the world in every war was not mine. I disagree with it politically. I felt that we were doing the wrong thing by invading. I did not believe in weapons of mass destruction. I did not believe in the stockpiles of chemical weapons and the links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. But I didn't really feel like I needed to make a stand because it didn't affect me. My career was going just fine. I was going to graduate from college at the same time. I was fathering my daughter. I was doing good things and living a very comfortable life in a very comfort zone. But then the war becomes very personal because I face the possibility of not coming back home, of going halfway across the world and actually participating in this war. The possibility of dying, the possibility of killing, and it all becomes real. And so I get deployed to the Middle East, and the Middle East becomes my home. It's no longer some distant place halfway across the world, but the place where I'm standing. And the people who are dying from our bullets, from our bombs, and from the missions that people like myself are conducting as infantrymen. Not because we're bad people, not because we're imperialists, not because we're criminals, but because we had no options, because we felt like we needed to go outside of our communities to find a college education, to find stability, to find independence. And so we find ourselves participating in this illegal invasion, this illegal occupation, in situations where, in order to survive, we have to kill. And I remember the first mission that we had in Iraq was in this place called Al-Assad, which was an Air Force base where they had these jet bunkers, and they had turned one of these bunkers into a detention center for Iraqi detainees. And they had these three people that were what they call in the military spooks, which is people that nobody knows who they are. They're wearing civilian clothing. They're experts in their own field. Perhaps, you know, they speak a different language, Arabic, or they're weapons experts, or they're interrogators. There's no accountability, there's no responsibility, because nobody knows who they are. If they belong to a unit, they may be CIA or FBI or some type of government agency. And they're the ones running this operation. And this is pretty relevant because we have a soldier being tried right now. Her name is PFC Lindy England, who's being tried for the abuse of prisoners. And we see that four officers just got cleared from an investigation conducted by the Pentagon. These are four top officers that just got cleared because they're saying that a lot of this prisoner abuse took place because of a few bad apples, because they just decided to do their own thing, because they decided to be bad. One day they woke up and they just felt like abusing prisoners out of nowhere. And there's nothing further removed from the truth from that, because when I got there, these three people were ordering soldiers, PFCs, privates, sergeants, staff sergeants, and above, to conduct abuse of prisoners in this base. And what they were doing, they were keeping people separate. They were separating the combatants and the non-combatants, and they were keeping the combatants on sleep deprivation to soften them up for interrogation. And the way we were told to do this was, you yell at these people and you tell them to get up and get down and turn around and do just dumb things by yelling at them. They're hooded and they're tied so they can recognize you. And if that doesn't work, then you grab a sledgehammer and you bang it against the wall and it sounds like an explosion and scares them. So they'll do anything you tell them to do. And then if that doesn't work, the way you keep these people up is you take a pistol and you charge it next to the head as to conduct a mock execution. And this scares them, this makes them do whatever you tell them to do. And that's how you keep people up for 48 hours, 72 hours. That's how you break them down psychologically in order to interrogate them. And this is May of 2003. And these are people who are not accountable because nobody knows where they come from, and they have top secret clearance to be conducting this type of missions. So when we face situations like the situation today, when we have this PFC, this private first class, being tried for abuse of prisoners, being called the bad apple, I just think about my own experience in the military, about how I myself was too afraid to question that, even though I had been politically against the war, even though I had questioned the war. And I thank my mother for teaching me how to question from a very young age. But I find myself doing the exact same things, perhaps not as intense, but the exact same things that these other soldiers are being tried for from the beginning of the war, systematic, from way up top as far as the leadership. Not just a few bad apples, but everybody. From the moment we got there, that's when the abuse started. Not in November of 2003. The minute we started detaining people, and perhaps even before that, we started abusing them. So this is my first experience in Iraq, the abuse of prisoner experience. So we have this shift. I start undergoing this shift in the war from a political opposition to the war in Iraq to a more personal opposition, because it's no longer a war far removed from my reality, but my reality, my surroundings, my actions. So it becomes very personal, it becomes very moral. But yet, I'm still afraid. The same reasons that led me to war, in disagreement with the war, the fear of being called a coward, the fear of being called a traitor, the fear of standing up to authority. So I kept on pushing my principles aside, not listening to the voice of my conscience, and continuing to carry out these missions that were very objectionable morally. And then we moved to another city, which is called Dar Ramadi. It's at the heart of the Sunni triangle. And in the beginning, we were welcomed by the people, although there is some resistance because this is one of the favorite cities by Saddam Hussein, because the Muslims there are Sunnis, and so there you have palaces and you have universities and factories and system of highways and other things. You can see the development in the city, so there was a higher level of insurgency, but the people still welcomed us because a lot of them were fed up with Saddam Hussein and they were saying that they were happy to see us there. But then days go by and then weeks go by and they realize that we're there to stay. And then we start getting into all these missions, these curfews, these raids, these traffic control points. And all the missions that conform an occupation, the humiliation of an entire nation. We're there and we're unaccountable. We're not responsible. We're not being pointed at every time we commit a crime or anything. And these people know what's going on. These people know that we're there because of the oil. These people know that they have no weapons of mass destruction. They know that they represented no threat to the United States. So what became as a welcoming feeling became resentment and hatred and anger. And the attacks become more intense and they become more frequent. And the people no longer want us to be there. And so we start getting into all these firefights. And here, I start dealing not only with the problem of the fabrication of the war, the fabrication of the reasons for the war, which are mainly political problems. The whole issue with weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. But now we start getting into the actual way that wars are fought. We start getting into the attitudes of the leadership. We start getting into missions that could be conducted a different way. And this, of course, is my experience. I'm not speaking for everybody there. But in our case, we're doing things deliberately to expose ourselves as soldiers and as infantrymen and as a unit in order to instigate firefights so that some of our officers and our leaders could get medals, could get awards, could get their combat experience or their glory. so that they could be promoted and they could build their careers. So we start giving away the element of surprise. We start following the same routes. We start doing the same missions over and over in the exact same way, knowing that we're not supposed to do that. We start conducting missions by mosques. We start conducting missions by hospitals, by schools, in their streets, in their neighborhoods. And we start engaging into firefights. And the people who pick up the tab are the innocent civilians. This one time we had a firefight. We had been told not to stay in one place for more than half an hour. We had been there way over an hour. We had detained everybody after we searched them, and we had kept them with us. Even though they had been cleared, they had no weapons, they had nothing, really, in order for us to keep them there. But we kept them, knowing that we shouldn't have kept them. We kept them there, we isolated them in an area. We were conducting this by the biggest mosque in Aramadi. And we knew that we were probably going to be attacked. And we knew that these people were in the way, and we still conducted the mission. We were attacked. They threw grenades at us. They launched rocket-propelled grenades. They hit us with machine gun fire. They hit us with AK-47 rifle fire. And we responded with everything we had. One of our soldiers got shot in the leg. Another one got shot in the vest. Nothing happened to him because of the vest. All of the insurgents got away. And in the middle of the firefight, at the end, there were 7 dead civilians. And this is not something that happened just once in a while, but this became a pattern. And a lot of people in the military who question my actions tell me, well, you know, it's war. It's acceptable loss. It's collateral damage. But as long as it is preventable, and as long as we went out of our way to instigate it, it cannot be acceptable. The human life should be preserved. And we're not taught to kill innocent people on purpose. We're not taught to go out of our way to make ourselves predictable and to give away the element of surprise in order to instigate firefights, because we know that we're exposing ourselves and that we're killing innocent civilians. But this is what's happening in Iraq. And from speaking with other veterans from different wars, from Korea, even World War II and Vietnam, this is something that is not exclusive to the war in Iraq, but this is something that happens in every war. It is the nature of war. That is how one gets to the enemy, by destroying the people, by destroying the infrastructure, by killing the morale, so that the people will not support the insurgency or support their president or their prime minister or their dictator. That's how wars are fought. So here I'm going on this conversion from being an infantryman and having a militaristic attitude and believing in fighting with weapons for democracy and freedom and against the war and terror, to realizing that this is a very unjustified war on political terms. And from there I go to not only being politically opposed to the war, but also morally opposed to the war and personally opposed to the war, to being politically and morally and personally opposed to every war. People have a right to defend themselves. That's true. But every time that we are attacked, innocent people die. It is not the insurgents who die. It is the people, the unarmed people. Over 100,000 Iraqis have died in these past 2 years. This is not including the victims of bombing in Iraq for over 10 years and the UN sanctions prompted by the United States and pressure for by the United States government. So, I lost my train of thought.
We love you.
Thank you. So I'm talking about this conversion where we have these 100,000 people who are dying on this war, and we have no justification for it. Basically, that's what I'm trying to say. So I'm going on this conversion from realizing that it's not just a political opposition to a particular war, but it's a more moral opposition because of the things that we're doing. And it's not just an opposition to a particular war, but also to every war because of the way that the war is being conducted and because of my experience with people, veterans from other wars. But at the same time, I want to say that it's really hard to make a stand, and it's really hard to take the time and have the clarity of mind when we're being attacked every day and every moment to say, this is a morally wrong war. This is, philosophically speaking, an unjustified war because we're in danger every step of the way. And every piece of trash on the road could be a bomb that could end our lives. So soldiers feel a lot of fear, and they feel a lot of anger and a lot of frustration. And instead of there being a moral questioning of the war, there is a questioning of the surrounding, trying to understand the environment, trying to read the signs that tell us that there's going to be an attack. So it's really hard for somebody trying to survive to at the same time make a moral stand and say, I'm not going to be a part of this war because everybody's just trying to get out of there alive. And also because, like Amy was saying, soldiers are being taught, wrongly in my opinion, that they don't have the right to oppose, that they don't have the right to stand up, that their job and their duty is to simply follow orders and to not use their judgment, to not use their feelings, and to not use their principles. But we do have a right to do that. But soldiers don't have the support within the military because what there is a lot of fear, and it's really difficult to make those choices. There's also the sense of camaraderie, and there's also the sense of brotherhood. So when I come home on a two-week leave, and I'm no longer being threatened, and every piece of junk on the road is not a bomb that can explode and kill me, and I'm not being shot at every step of the way, then I have a little bit of time and a little bit of clarity of mind to actually think about these things. And people want to know, people always ask questions about, were you in firefights? Were you shot at? Were you ambushed? Were you bombed? And when you tell these stories, you actually relive the stories. It brings you back to that experience, and it's very vivid, and it's very real. And for the first time, I'm reliving these experiences, and I'm trying to deal with the things that I did. And I'm trying to deal with the things that I didn't do. And suddenly I find myself with no reason and with no purpose for being a part of this war. Suddenly I find myself with enough clarity of mind to ask the question, what am I doing in this war? Why am I participating in this war? And the people that we killed, they come back to memory. And one can only ask oneself, is it justified? Do we have a right to be there? And it becomes, or at least for myself, for me, it became impossible to deal with the fact that I was participating in a very immoral, illegal, and criminal war for no reason. To deal with the fact that not only if militarily speaking or politically speaking, this war could be justified and we could make a case that there are weapons of mass destruction that they were actually going to be used or that there were chemical weapons, to deal with the fact that we are defeating the enemy by killing their people, by killing the innocent civilians, by killing the children, by destroying the infrastructure, the power, the water, the food source. So I decide not to go back to the war. I decide to make a stand and to say I'm not going to participate in this war. And in the beginning, I did try to, I guess, negotiate with the military because there's already a draft going on. There is more than one draft or two drafts, and one is a socioeconomic draft, the draft that is taking place in schools with people like Amy and myself who wanted an education but didn't have the means to acquire one, with people who want options but feel like they don't have them, with people who need financial security, stability, a sense of belonging, and who are being attacked by recruiters who show up with pizza and video games and barbecue parties and the promise of a college education. Amy, Amy, Amy. Camilo, Camilo, Camilo. We see it. It's happening every day in our schools, in our communities. That is a socioeconomic draft already taking place. And there is the other draft that they're calling the backdoor draft, which is keeping soldiers beyond their contract, which is keeping soldiers and servicemen and women from changing their specialties within the military. So there were a lot of violations when it came to my extension and when it came to my deployment to the Middle East. And I brought up those issues to the military, and they said, "We're sorry, you're right, you should have never been deployed, you should have never been extended, but we are at war and you have to go back." So those were two separate things, not going back to the war and not going back to the military. So I decided not only to not go back to the war, but also to not go back to the military and to find myself civilian counsel. And all we have to do... And all we have to do is look around ourselves to see all the support that there is out there for people who actually want to make that principle stand. People who actually want to refuse the war, because there is help out there. There is help, and it's important for soldiers and service members to know that there is this help available. So I decided to find a civilian counsel, and at the same time I'm writing a conscientious objector application because I am also a conscientious objector. And I didn't know I was a conscientious objector, and it was because of one of these organizations, the CCCO, the Central Committee on Conscientious Objector, the San Francisco chapter, or actually the Oakland chapter, who actually told me, "Yes, you did go to war. Yes, you are, or you were a combat squad leader, and you were in combat, but you still can be a conscientious objector." And I didn't know that, because there's a lot of secrecy in the military when people want to find out about being a conscientious objector. But it was because of these organizations and because of my mother, who's sitting right there, my whole family, that I actually had the courage and the strength to make that decision not to go back to the military. And I also want to say that this sense of brotherhood and that this sense of belonging is also a very heavy factor in this decision, that a lot of people who go back to the war, who are against it, who know that this is a war for oil, decide to go back to the war because they don't want to be away from their family, their military family, their comrades in arms. And I want to say that to me, it was very painful to not go back because of those people. But I also want to say that there's no sense of brotherhood and that there's no sense of camaraderie that will ever justify participating in this crime against humanity that is the war in Iraq. So it was a very hard decision. It's probably the hardest decision that I've made in my life, but it's not a decision that I will ever regret. So I resurfaced after 5 months of clandestine life with a conscientious objector application, and I give a press conference saying that I've been to Iraq and we're committing crimes and that I'm against the war and that this is an oil-driven war, and that no service member ever signed a military contract to be a mercenary, and that I'm not going back to the war. And immediately after the press conference, I surrendered to the military, to an Air Force base in Massachusetts. And 2 months later, I was tried by a special court-martial, and I was found guilty of desertion. And I was sentenced to demotion from the rank of staff sergeant, forfeiture of 2/3 of my pay, 12 months of confinement in a military confinement facility, and a bad conduct discharge. So off I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, the regional corrections facility, which became my home for almost 9 months. And just a few weeks after being incarcerated, I was adopted by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience, the first one since the first Gulf War, a political prisoner within the United States. And because of that, and because of other organizations who also in their own ways adopted me, I received tremendous help and tremendous support from the community. Not only the world community, but the community also within the United States, because there's a lot of people who are against this war here and who are not coming together just yet. And I think the mainstream media is portraying that there's a split. There's a 50% split in America. 50% who support the war and 50% who don't support the war. And it's been my experience that the majority of the people in the United States do not support the war. We need to get out of that mentality. If we're going to talk about two halves, we're going to say that one half support the war, that one half is against the war and that the other half does not know enough about it. So it is our job to bring forward this information so that the other half can join us and so that we as a nation can oppose the war and stop it. So I received a lot of support, and I want to say that I know that there are some families dealing with their own tragedies, dealing with their own soldiers and Marines and members of different branches of the military who are really afraid of their children and their husbands and their brothers and sisters, perhaps trying to escape this war. And there's a lot of uncertainty and there's a lot of fear of being tried. And there's a lot of fear of being called a coward and being ostracized and being humiliated and going to jail. And I can speak for everybody, but I can say that myself, when I went to jail, I felt like a free person because I had listened to my conscience and I had done what I believed to be the right thing. And I went to jail with no regrets. And I also want to say that it is better to go to jail to not kill anymore. It is better to go to jail to not kill at all than to not kill anymore. So if they haven't been to the war, stay out of it. You don't want that experience. Go to jail. I had a great time in jail. I did, actually. They had cappuccino machines. And we had ice cream on the weekends, too. And my mom wouldn't stop visiting me. So then I came out of jail on February 15th, and I've been doing this political activism ever since. And I've joined an organization called Iraq Vets Against the War. And I believe that there's a sign here. And the three main points in our organization is to remove the troops from Iraq, give them the proper care, because a lot of them are being abandoned and forgotten by the government. A lot of people are coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, alcoholism, and coming back really violent, coming back with no job. A lot of the people from the National Guard and the reserves, who depended on civilian jobs are coming back to nothing. They've lost homes. And the government is really not coming forward to help them. So when they say support the troops, what they're actually saying is support the war so that we can give more money to the corporations. It's very hypocritical. So our three main points are to remove the troops from Iraq, to bring them home now. That's one. The second one is to give them the proper care. And then the third one is to help the people in Iraq. Now, I want to point out that that's just the beginning, because I believe the war in Iraq is just a catalyst of a bigger picture, a picture of social injustice, the picture of the main problem in America, which is corporate greed. And I think that people need to start making bigger connections, start seeing beyond the war, and start seeing how the corporations are actually destroying our environment, destroying people, destroying movements of social justice all over America and the world, so that they can advance their economic agendas all throughout the world. So let the war be a catalyst, but let's not get stuck in the war, and let's try to look beyond that and work towards world justice. So while I was incarcerated, I received a few words, and the city of Detroit passed a couple of resolutions in support of my actions. And I want to say that, and I believe that every warrior sister will agree with me, that I don't feel worthy of having my own day. You know, that's pretty surreal. What do you say to something like that? You know, Camilo Mejia Day. It doesn't sound real. But it is. It's right in front of me. So I don't think I deserve it, but I also think it's very arrogant of me to think that this is about me, because this is really not about me. This is about a community, and this is an entire city coming together to say no to war. This is about an entire community coming together and supporting resistance, which is exactly what we need to do. We need to support resistance. We need to support troops that are coming forward and saying, no, I'm not going to fight this immoral war. So because of that, it is my honor to accept this proclamation. So let today not be Camilo Mejia Day, but let today be a day of resistance and the day that the city of Santa Cruz came together and said no to war. Thank you very much.
I am extremely happy to say that for the next 35 minutes, we'll have a chance to formulate our questions and ask Camilo those. We will do our best to get to as many questions as we can. And while you're doing that, we've got some youth organizations that have some questions prepared. And I'm going to give a minute for a representative from each of these organizations to ask the first questions just to get us started. And then, Camilo, you can come and respond. The first organization is Free Radio. Dan, you have a question?
Your family's here, so perhaps I should ask them, but I'm wondering how your family reacted to your initial enlistment in the military.
It was pretty shocking for my family because, not just because of my political background, both my father and my mother were very involved in the Sandinista Revolution. So it was a huge shock for them, you know, to have a child actually joining the military, the U.S. military of all militaries. But it was also the same type of reaction that any families may have to their children joining the military because of lack of options. The sadness is no different from the sadness of regular people, regular families. I have a question here that somebody asked. It says, the Marine caught on film shooting the wounded Iraqi in the Fallujah Mosque was just acquitted this afternoon. Please comment. What I have to say about that is that it should not surprise you that this is going on, because this is going on for a long time. From the moment that we heard about the Abu Ghraib scandal, from the moment that we invaded and we occupied Iraq, we started engaging in a series of violations of international law and a series of crimes against humanity that people have not really paid attention to. So it's very unfortunate that this happened, and that we, and I say we because I'm still a member of the military, that we as a military are not being held accountable for our actions. But it is important for people to see beyond the phenomenal news, the spectacular news, you know, somebody shoots somebody on camera and it's caught on camera. But how about 100,000 Iraqis dead? How about that? How about the Abu Ghraib scandal and the top four officers in charge being acquitted or being cleared by an investigation? How about an entire city, which is the city of Fallujah, being encircled by a razor-sharp wire and their residents having to present an ID, American-made ID, to enter their own city? How about that? How about taking the hospital as being the first action that the U.S. military took in taking Fallujah? Those are all clear violations of international law. So let's not get caught up on the big news. Let's look at everything that's going on every day, and let's come together, and let's take back the power from the government, because they're doing things that are against the will of Americans, against the will of the good people who hate war and who hate crimes against humanity. So let's not get caught up on the little things. Let's start looking at the bigger picture.
Our next question will come from Youth Coalition Santa Cruz, Captain Ricoli.
What do you think are the best ways to outreach to the uneducated people and open their eyes on this very important issue?
When you talk about the uneducated people, you're talking about an awful lot of people. But I think we should concentrate on two major groups, and one of those groups is the young children, the young people in the high schools who are being lured into the military with the promise of an education and the promise of stability and the promise of adventure. There are options out there, and there's support out there for these people, and we need to reach out to them. We need to show them that they don't have to join the military. And I guess the best way to do this is not by telling them, don't join the military. Because the minute you tell somebody not to do something, that's exactly what they're going to do. So show them the real picture. Show them the options. Show them that there are organizations out there that will pay for school, that they can go to a public school and not pay as much money, that they can apply themselves in school and get a high GPA and get scholarships. And also, let's do our best to also show them the reality of war, to also show them that bullets fly both ways, that they're no longer going to be shooting at paper targets or plastic targets. They're going to actually be killing people, and not uniformed people, not combatants, but innocent people. Once people see this reality, once people see what they're getting into, that it's not just a life of adventure and going to the biggest mall in Turkey or all the promises, the empty promises that the recruiters come up with, but also the reality of war and also showing them the options that there are available, I think that's going to have a huge impact, because we're going to cut the source of the military, and that's really important. The other group of people that I think we should concentrate on are the people who we quickly dismiss as conservatives or right-wingers or war hawks. The majority of the people don't have that mentality. You know, when we look at somebody and they're Republican or they're conservatives or they're, you know, so-called war hawks, we completely turn our backs and we feel that they're on the other side and that we can't talk to them. No, these people, if only they saw war, if only they saw the reality of war, they would hate it just as much as we hate it. If these people actually saw the benefits of peace and these people actually saw what we're doing through our foreign policy, they wouldn't stand by that. So let's be less divisive and let's unite and let's open up and reach out to the people that we're dismissing as being on the other side, and let's come together and let's concentrate on that.
Our next question will come from Harbor High student for Peace and Justice, J.T. Beggs.
Hi, Camila. First, I'd like to thank you from Harbor High Students for Peace and Justice for coming to Santa Cruz and speaking here today. And we've been kind of thinking about getting together a conscientious objector workshop at our school, and we do counter-military recruitment stuff, but I was wondering what your experiences were filing for the CO status, and what would be your recommendations for high school students building one of these possible, for the possible drafts, and did the military court seem forgiving, or do they seem harsh, or is it easy, and what would your recommendations be for getting in there?
I think I'll remember every question. The first question was about being a conscientious objector and how that process was for me, right? Okay, well, conscientious objection in the beginning, when I first joined the military, a friend of mine filed as a conscientious objector, and I thought it was kind of weird. I remember that he actually put tape on the targets so that it wouldn't look like a human figure. And I thought he was really dumb for doing that. I didn't realize the depth of thought that this person had, the spirituality that this person had, and I dismissed him as a freak, really. And then, later on, as I began my process of rejection of war and violence, another person applied for conscientious objection right before the war. And this time, it's not that I really saw him as weird or anything, but I just felt that, you know, right before the war, this person's filing for conscientious objection. That just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, why didn't he file like a year ago or 2 years ago? I'm thinking this right before I'm going to war. And there's also, I want to say, there's also a lot of secrecy, and there's also a lot of suppression when it comes to conscientious objection in the military. A lot of people believe that this is something exclusive to Vietnam or exclusive to wars that had conscription, and that it's only draftees who have the right to apply for conscientious objection. So there's a lot of ignorance within the military about conscientious objection. There's a lot of humiliation involved to the people who are actually applying. I know Jeff was one of them who thought that, you know, conscientious objectors were all weird people. And I felt the same way. It's important to let people know that a conscientious objector is not somebody who is a conscientious objector outside of the military or before joining the military. Going to war and actually seeing war gives everybody every right and every reason to be against the war and to hate war because they actually see the results of war. They actually participate in it, and it's important for people to know that. However, I also want to say that it is important for people outside of the military who feel like they are conscientious objectors to start working towards that purpose because there probably is going to be a draft. I don't doubt it. I don't see it as something very far away from us. So I encourage everybody to apply for conscientious objection, to register, you know, on selective service and put conscientious objection if they want to register, and I'm not telling people to register, but to start proactively demonstrating and expressing their conscientious objection to war. And then the other question was about the trial. The court martial was really a kangaroo trial. I remember that because it had been a very high-profile case, because I was the first person to actually come back from the war and publicly denounce the war and refuse to go back. So it was a test case for the military. It was a political case, not a legal case. And they had to send a message to the world and to the rest of servicemen and women in the military that we're not going to tolerate conscientious objection, that we're not going to tolerate criticism, that we're not going to open the door for people to leave the military and to leave the war on moral grounds. So I remember that I was confined for 2 months before my court-martial, and they told me, you can be interviewed, but only on post. And they told reporters, yeah, you can interview him, but you can't go on post. So it was a catch-22 thing, and this was like the first thing. And then the day of my court-martial, they took away the cameras and the recording devices from all the reporters. And they kept them isolated in this area that was like a mile away from the courthouse. And they told them any press conferences and any camera action is going to happen here. You're not allowed to bring all that in the courtroom. And I had been attending court-martials because I wanted to become familiar with the process. And for the first time, I saw in my court-martial that they filled up half of the courtroom with soldiers. They detailed soldiers to fill up half of the courtroom because there were a lot of people who had shown up to support me, people from different organizations, my family, a lot of friends, and they had filled up half of the courthouse in order to keep supporters outside. Also, they restrained the entry to the base to people who only the people who were involved in the trial and people who had military IDs, and they directed everybody to gate number 3, and they took down the signs that led to the gate so that people would get lost. They barricaded the entire block around the courthouse, and they had working dogs sniffing around the courtroom. I kept looking around looking for Osama bin Laden because I thought that some hardcore terrorist was being tried that day. And they had military and civilian police officers patrolling the area. It was just a front, you know. They knew that there was a lot of support, and they knew that a lot of people were protesting the court-martial, that a lot of people were demanding my release from the military as a conscientious objector. And at the same time, they had taken a lot of heat from the Abu Ghraib scandal, which had just broken out just a couple of weeks before that. So it was very unfair. It was very biased. And I remember that just as I got sentenced, my mother and some of my relatives went to my barracks room to pick up my belongings, and it was all gone. So they had actually broken into my room before I was sentenced, and they had gathered up all my belongings and put them in bags because they knew that I was going away even before my sentencing. So it was a very unfair trial. They knew they were going to put me away. It was just for them to say, hey, yeah, we do try people. We do give people a fair chance. In the trial itself, all of our motions, and I want to say that one of the attorneys in my defense team was former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. So he was there. We had in our team two experts in international law and military law. My attorney was himself a conscientious objector and a West Point cadet, trained in West Point, Harvard, and Yale. His wife and partner was there, and my defense team was five attorneys, and they presented a number of motions to dismiss the trial, which were supported by several attorneys who were experts in their own field, and all these motions were struck down by the judge. My conscientious objector claim was struck down by the judge. Of about 30 witnesses that we called up, only about four were allowed to testify. So it was a very unfair trial. It was a trial bound to fail, and it was just a front put on by the military. And what was the other question? Was there another question? That's about it? Okay.
I have an announcement that I was asked to read. The Bill Motto Post most regretfully must leave for a regular meeting this evening, but we are proud to be a part of this evening. So they may be leaving, but that's why.
You can go to jail and come out okay. If that's the worst thing that can happen, then they can't do very much to us, can they? The next question is going to be from UCSC Students Against War, Rosalina Bonilla.
Okay. One of my first questions was, did you get any money from the GI Bill and for college?
The question was, did I get any money from the GI Bill?
Yeah, for college.
Yeah, the GI Bill money I got actually from the active duty enlistment. And I had done that, and I had earned that money from those initial three years. When I extended my participation in the military with the National Guard, which isn't really an extension, because let me explain this. Every military contract is 8 years long. So if you join the military for 3 years and you get out, and you don't join the National Guard or the Reserves, you're still stuck for another 5 years. Until those 8 years are up, you're still in the military, and you still can be stop-loss and extended for an incredible amount of time, you know, like maybe 27 years. So my decision to, instead of completely getting out of the military and going to the National Guard, didn't really have that much effect on whether I would end up going to the war or not, because they still have the ability to extend you and they still have the ability to activate you. One of the considerations was that they offered to waive tuition for people who joined the National Guard. So I figured, hey, I have my GI Bill, which I've earned whether I go to Guard or Reserve or not, and then they'll waive tuition. So I got out, I have my GI Bill, which I was using. The GI Bill for me was $25,000, total amount of $25,000. And they pay it in monthly installments while you're going to school. If you're going to school full-time, you get the full amount, which for me at that time was like $900, which paid some bills. And with the National Guard tuition waiver, I was able to go to school and use the GI Bill money to pay for some bills. However, what they don't tell you is that for receiving this tuition waiver, at the end of this tuition waiver, at the end of your degree, once you get your degree, you're stuck in the military another 3 years. So it's not really free. And then the other thing was that I transferred from a public school to a private school, and they told me, we're not going to pay for a private school. And this private school was about $32,000 a year. And I had a GI Bill that was $25,000 a year, so it didn't cover that. And they told me, well, you can transfer to another private school and sign another contract as an officer, and then we'll pay for school. So it's not really as free as they portray it to be. They say, yeah, it's free. You'll get free tuition. But what you don't know is that you're basically signing for another contract and that you're basically only going to go to a school that they tell you that where you can go. It's not the school of your choice. If it comes to private school, you know, you have to be rich or, you know, be a good student and, you know, get a merit scholarship or, you know, find some other way. And there are ways. I remember going to different bookstores and buying myself a cup of coffee and just reading these books that were this thick. And they're all about scholarships. So I would just buy a coffee and spend 8 hours in these bookstores and just apply for different scholarships. And I got like 4 or 5 of them. And these are scholarships that are available to people without joining the military. So yeah, I did receive the GI Bill, but it wasn't enough. And there are tricks in these contracts and there are tricks in these benefits. So beware of that.
And I also wanted to ask, what do you plan to do so people, or most specifically college students, don't get sucked into the military?
What do I plan to do?
Yeah, like, besides, like, raising awareness by speaking to all of us, but, like, personally, I guess, what do you plan to do?
Well, right now, we're thinking at Iraq Veterans Against the War about putting together a kind of recruiting program. But we're not going to concentrate on colleges. We're going to concentrate on high schools because people going to college... People going to college already have a better idea of what's going on, and they've already found ways to finance their education. And the kids going to high school, they're the most vulnerable, so we're going to concentrate on that.
Okay. And the Brown Berets?
I got two questions. The first one is, were there people in your infantry that were opposed to the war but did not speak up because they would face the same situation that you faced? Second is... Do you think that if you wouldn't have been allowed to come back home for the 2 weeks, would you still be in Iraq? And why?
Okay, so the first question was, were people voicing disagreement with the war in Iraq in my unit? And the answer to that question is no, they weren't. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is that there's a lot of fear in the military. Nobody wants to be unpopular and say, this war is about oil. This is an immoral war. There's a lot of feelings of camaraderie and, you know, a misled sense of patriotism. And we heard the rhetoric before the war, with us or against us, the axis of evil, the Patriot Act. You know, this language, it has a very strong effect on young minds, you know, when it comes to opposing the war. You know, nobody wants to be unpatriotic. Nobody wants to be a coward. Nobody wants to be a traitor. So even if people do disagree with the war, at the unit level, and particularly in combat environments, I imagine mostly in the beginning of a war, you're not going to hear a lot of voices standing up or saying, you know, I disagree with this war. While I was incarcerated, I did hear about a unit, and I believe 19 people refused to go on a suicide mission, what they called a suicide mission. They were truck drivers. And I was very happy to hear that because we were sent on a lot of suicide missions. So dissent is coming forward. I think it's going to probably take more time and it's going to take more support from people here at home. And also it's going to take for people in the peace movement, in the anti-war movement, to make it clear that we're not against the troops. That being against the war is not being against the troops. And it's important to make that distinction so that soldiers feel supported and soldiers don't feel marginalized or like they're being criticized. It's not against the war. It's not against the soldiers. It's against the war. And what was the other question? Well, it's really hard to tell. I was already refusing certain things while I was there, but it wasn't as much of a moral thing. It was a moral thing, but it was more of a tactical thing. They were conducting missions in a way that exposed soldiers unnecessarily, and I stood up to that. For instance, you know, when they were making us do missions by the mosque, I was saying, you know, we shouldn't do this by the mosque. When they were making us stay at a place for too long, I was saying we shouldn't stay here. But these are all things that deal mostly with surviving and deal mostly with staying alive and doing things in a way that do not expose you, that do not expose your life or the lives of the people you're with and also the lives of civilians. But it's really hard to actually think in terms of the illegality of the war and the you know, the fact that you're engaging in a crime against humanity because you're so caught up in trying to survive that it's really difficult. I wouldn't be there because deployment ended, so it was just for a year. I know that some people in my unit are going back to Afghanistan, But it's not going to be the entire unit, but it's going to be like some of the people from my unit are going to end up going to Afghanistan. And I imagine they're going to be recycled once more, and they're going to end up either going full-blown, the entire unit, either to Iraq or Afghanistan. So there's no doubt in my mind that that will happen.
Okay. For the next 10 minutes, I've taken your wonderful questions and compiled them into some categories that haven't been talked about so far. And you're welcome to give me one more, and I'll see if it can fit. We have about 10 minutes, so I'll ask the first question, which is that it's a very direct question. How do I convince my good friend who's in the military that it's worthwhile for him to avoid participating in this war?
Well, it's really hard when it comes to convincing and trying to tell people what to do, because everybody has a different calling. I can't expect everybody to be a conscientious objector. I can't expect everybody to be a pacifist or to stand for nonviolence. I can't expect everybody to say, I'm not going to go back to war, I'm going to just take a jail sentence. What you can do is encourage the people that you know in the military to listen to the voice of their conscience, to listen to what their heart is telling them. And for a lot of people, that's going to mean either not go to the war or go to the war, but you know, not commit any crimes against humanity, not abuse people, not kill innocent civilians, stand up to authority. It just may mean a lot of things, but basically what I would do is I would support them, and I would encourage them to find their path, to find their way, and to act upon it.
There are several questions about as you left the military as a veteran. Has the Iraqi Vets Against the War identified resources for returning vets beyond what the government provides? And would you explain your own personal experience for debriefing after you left Iraq?
Okay, I can say that I'm very familiar with the resources that I've identified or that the organization has identified. Mostly what we found are stories of soldiers who have come back and have received no support whatsoever. There's this case of this soldier named Lucy who came back, and he was highly disrupted by the war, and he was suffering from severe depression, and he sought help from the Veterans Hospital, and they dismissed him as an alcoholic. I'm not sure if it was days or weeks later that he hung himself. So now his parents are, you know, doing political activism, creating awareness. And there are many cases like that where people come back and, you know, they're really violent and they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and the military is not really taking care of these people. So one way to deal with the issue is to create awareness, and I think that's what the concentration is on right now.
There are several questions about, you mentioned about your brotherhood that you were part of, this camaraderie and this family. And many people have a question about how people that are closest to you, your comrades, reacted to your decision to become a conscientious objector, and then how you were treated while you were in confinement in the brig.
The majority of the people in my unit were really supportive, because when I came forward and I denounced the war, not only did I denounce the war at the higher level, but I also said that our leadership was using us as bait and that they were doing everything. They were breaking all the rules in order to instigate firefights. And this is something that everybody in my unit knew was really happening, but nobody wanted to come forward and say anything because everybody was afraid. So when I actually came forward, the vast majority of the people within my unit were behind me, even though they weren't saying anything publicly. When I was confined in Fort Stewart, Georgia, they put me in the medical hold battalion, which is the battalion where they keep all the people who come back from Iraq injured. And a lot of these people were being neglected by the military. They were being forgotten. They were not being able to see a doctor. They were not being able to receive the proper care. So they knew that I was telling the truth, and they were very supportive. There was one person who was against everything that I did out of about 100 people within my unit, and that was the only person who actually wrote a very nasty email to me, as opposed to everybody else who has been really, really, really supportive. And when I went to the confinement facility in the military, confinement facility is actually a different type of environment, because the people who are afraid to speak because they're afraid to be called a coward, or they're afraid to be called a traitor, or they're afraid to be called, you know, whatever crime they're about to commit or they committed, or they're afraid to face a court martial and they're afraid to go to jail, already have gone through that. So they feel like they've got nothing to lose. So when I find myself in the military prison, everybody's pretty much, you know, just dissing the army and, you know, coming forward and being honest about their feelings. And most of them are saying, you know, you're right. You know, this is a war for oil and, you know, you did the right thing. You shouldn't have come back. So there was a lot of support because people were less afraid to come forward and speak.
This next question is actually a compilation of several. People want to know, one, what's the one thing the recruiter said to you that convinced you to sign that contract? And what's the one thing that happened to you that crystallized your opposition to war and made you become a CO?
Okay, actually, the recruiter had a pretty easy job with me because I already made up my mind when I called them. Because it wasn't really, it didn't really come down to what the recruiter said to me about the options that I had in front of me. I didn't feel like I had any options. I didn't feel like I was finding that sense of camaraderie, friendship, companionship. I wanted to have a stable job. I wanted to live an adventurous life. I wanted to become independent, and I wanted to go to school. So the military offered all that. So the recruiter didn't really have to say anything. But I remember the recruiter told me, join the infantry. You'll get the best training. You'll be the cream of the military. Everybody will envy you. You'll be the toughest, and you'll be sleeping in the back of a truck. Well, I wasn't sleeping in the back of a truck because we were being blown up on the roads, and that's the thing that recruiters don't say. So it wasn't really hard for the recruiter to say, you know, to recruit me. You know, I had already recruited myself because I didn't feel like I had any options. And then when it comes to that crystallization, it didn't really happen that way for me. And I believe this is what happens with most people that I've spoken with. It is a process. You know, you don't wake up one day and have an image or hear, you know, a voice. You know, when I speak about the voice of my conscience, I'm not talking about, you know, a little voice telling me, don't go to war. I'm actually talking about a process of exploration, a process of search for answers, for purpose. And it's not something that happens suddenly, you know, it's a very painful process. There's this sense of camaraderie. There's this fear of being tried. And I guess if we want to summarize it, the thing that would crystallize later on, and I'm still going through this process, would be that sense that I'm not in control. The sense that even though I'm not behind bars, or I'm not chained, or I don't have handcuffs in my hand, I'm not free to decide for my own self what is right and what is wrong, what I can or cannot do. I was being given orders, and I didn't feel like I had the freedom, and I didn't have the internal power to say no, I'm not going to abuse this human being, to say no, I'm not going to open fire on these people because civilians are going to be killed. I felt like I wasn't free to follow my heart. And that's, I guess, the catalyst. You know, if you want to look at a particular feeling, at a particular emotion, is the idea that the military owns you, that they control you, that they can put you in a war environment where to survive you have to kill innocent people. And that sense of impotence, I guess, would be the major driving force as it refers to my experience in the military. Other major things that drove me to make my decision was the support of my family and then, of course, my little daughter, who has always been a driving force ever since she was born.
Okay, two more questions. Is everyone okay? Good. I'm going to combine two questions here. First, a comment. Camilo, thank you for enduring your struggle with such grace and love. Has the military contacted you about your CO work, your speaking engagements? Have they threatened or tried to silence you? I heard the United States may take some action against your citizenship status. Is that true?
I don't know that the military is following me. Sometimes I feel a little paranoid. But I really don't care if they're listening or if they're following me around. I think I hear a click every now and then when I'm on the phone. Just in case I say hello to any agents, you know, who might be listening. I know that in some events that I've participated, they've asked people to leave the event because they've gone in to take pictures of the people and to annotate names of the people who are attending. So there is infiltration. I don't know to what extent. I don't know to what level. But it's not stopping me from doing what I think is my duty.
Okay.
Thank you. And the issue of citizenship, actually, it's not really affecting me because my crime, my desertion AWOL crime, does not really translate or does not really, it does not have an equivalent in the civilian world. Because if people would just want to leave a job, they leave a job. They put in a two-week notice or they just walk out. So there's no crime in the civilian world for AWOL or desertion. And then the other thing is that it's not a sex crime, and it's not a drug crime, and it's not a violent crime. So it does not meet the requirements for deportation. However, if I leave the United States without being a citizen, they have the right to not let me back in. So for the moment, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm staying here. It's a pretty big and beautiful jail, and I'm in pretty good company, so I don't really care that much about that.
Thank you. Our last question, lots of people here want to know what your plans are. And so what are your academic plans for the future? If you're pursuing a PhD in psychology, how will you use this to further your activism? Or what do you plan to do? What do you hope to do in your future?
I think I'm going to be doing this for a while. It's very tiring, but it's very uplifting spiritually. And I may lose my train of thought every now and then, but I don't lose my purpose in doing this. So I'm going to be doing this for a while, but I also intend to go back to school next year. And I only have one semester, and I'm going to take a break after I get my bachelor's degree. And I'm going to do more political activism, more political troublemaking. And I'm also going to write a book pretty soon. So I hope you all read it. And I don't think I'm going to go to the... I'm not going to apply for the PhD program in psychology anymore. I think I'm going to opt for law or for international relations.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent. Camilo. You are our hero. You give us hope. Thank you. Thank you.